Thank you, Carol. It's a pleasure to be here, far away from home. And I think it will be a very interesting afternoon with personal experiences here. And I thought I'd start my part with my personal experience, how I came to write a whole book on art and mourning. And I will start with that, and then I give a small, more theoretical introduction to the theme with some words of Sigmund Freud. We are, after all, here. Now, my funny accent, which my patients in A call a Freudian accent, comes from Switzerland, where I'm originally from, and I've lived several years in Israel, so it's a funny mixture, so I hope you bear with me. My book, Art and Mourning, is intimately connected with my mother's life and death. Despite a distance that spanned on an ocean, my brothers and I felt closer to our mother in the last few years of her life. As my once strong and competent mother became more physically and psychologically dependent on us. In her final years, she resided in the very Jewish home for the elderly in Zurich that she and my father had directed 25 years earlier. I spent much of my childhood living in that very same home, from the time I was 10 till to my 20th birthday. It was an uncanny experience to grow up with so many old people, most of whom never left the premises except to go to the hospital or to be buried in the cemetery. After a resident died, they would actively be mourned, especially by my mother and the deceased family. And my parents would perform all the proper Jewish mourning rites. In my frequent visits from LA to Zurich during that time, this nursing home where my mother grew older and weaker, my childhood came rushing back to me. During one of my final visits with my mother, we attended a piano concert with many of the old elderly residents in the large living room of the facility. As I sat next to my 92-year-old mother, my eyes flickered across the room and my memory did somersaults. I used to sit in the very same room as a young child some 50 years earlier when my parents directed the nursing home and the family resided on the fifth floor. While I attempted to make my mother comfortable on the wooden chair, my eyes wandered from the young Russian man preparing his music to Mrs. Fisher, a retired pianist in her late 90s. Now slumped in her wheelchair beside my mother, she had performed here in the same residency 40 years prior as a younger woman. Under a halo of white hair, her pale face twitched. Each discordant note seemed to line up and march against her own memory. Her fingers tapped the rhythm on her armrest, and her eyebrows moved so slightly with each mistake the young pianist made. Back and forth, watching Miss Fisher and my mother, I studied each of their pale, tired faces and their pale, trembling hands. Suddenly, it felt as though time itself divided, and I saw myself sitting in the same hall at the age of 10. The familiar sight of the crumbled faces and purple sweaters throughout the room and the strong odor of the nursing home in the air brought back an earlier time. When the piano player back in the days, 50 years earlier, my 40 grandparents in the room saw their bygone childhood in me and hoped to partake in my childhood, in my life that was still to come. In me, the child whose life had just begun, they must have also recognized their own lives coming to an end. Suddenly, the music pulled me back to the present and the room full of very old friends and strangers. Miss Fisher, the erstwhile musician, now seemed out of sorts starting across the room, and my eyes followed her to the door, where a nurse entered with Miss Ginger, the old resident in the home. I realized that my mother's anxiety was also rising, as she looked nervously at the two women entering. As so frozen in time, Miss Ginger sat up straight in her wheelchair, one of her hands clutching a yellow tennis ball. She stared into another universe, her eyes locked in midair, and the piano music did not appear to affect her. It seemed her aide has forgotten the earring aid. I could not take my eyes off the yellow ball. Something about that yellow ball triggered my memory. The yellow ball in Mrs. Ginger's wrinkled hand now seemed to roll down a long incline of my memory, bouncing down the steps all the way to the first floor and to the backyard. I ran after a little girl in a white dress and red boots. I wanted to catch the ball so badly when it came to an abrupt stop. I bent down to pick it up. And what was this thing I saw lying next to it? I wondered, hiding in the wet, uncombed lawn. I picked up a twig and tried to move the unfamiliar object, but suddenly I started to tremble. I ran up the stairs to the administrative office into my mother's arms. She looked up to me for a brief minute, slightly annoyed. I tucked on her skirt and gestured, and she hung up and followed me to the backyard. My mother finally found the yellow ball, but then her eyes followed the strange objects in the grass. "Dentures!" she cried, laughing uproariously. I did not understand. My mother slowly explained to me that old people often lose their teeth and sometimes even lose their dentures. Bewildered, I stared at the artificial teeth, feeling confused about old age and the place I now was to call my home. As I looked at the ball stuck in Mrs. Ginger's hand, I pulled back and forced between the past and the present. My childhood memories stood like uninvited guests, lingering shadows behind each of these old residents. One night I was home alone. The nurse Nina, who always wore a very big silver cross, called on me. I was 12 years old, and nobody was at home. She said one of the old residents, Mrs. Friedman, had passed away. Unable to reach my parents or the doctor, she asked that I sit with the body for a short time while she attended to all the other patients. I was dumbfounded, but agreed, remembering the many times my mother had explained to me what a privilege it was to sit with the dead. It was special, a peaceful experience based on the law, the commandment to watch over a departed body, as they must not be left alone from the moment of passing until burial. I shuddered as I stared into the motionless face of Miss Ginger. I was thinking, as I was sitting next to my mother, who got weaker and weaker and seemed to fall into herself. And I accompanied her slowly to her room as other people left. I had to undress her, help her into her bed as she got more and more tired. I read her favorite poem to her, and it made her going to sleep. However, two nights before my mother's death, While she was suffering from overwhelming pain, my mother recalled by heart the poem Mondnacht, Moonlit Night by the romantic German poet Josef Eichendorff. Not only was she able to access her wish and need to, quote, fly home, but she could identify with the comforting, embracing feeling of the limitless universe so beautifully expressed in the poet. I read it to you in English. Moonlit night. It was as though the heavens glimmer, silently kissed the earth, that in its blossom shimmer she dreamed of his verse. The breeze moved through the wheat fields and swayed the heads of grain. The forest softly rustled, so starry the night was again. And oh, my soul extended, far wide, its wing to roam, sailing through hushed lands, as if my soul was flying home. My mother's recollection of this particular poem stored in her memory helped both of us in the final days of her life to connect to her creative inner core and to her mourning for her own life. A creative transformational object, this poetic imagery fostered a reverie that helped her rise for a short while beyond her pained body, accessing an extended moment, the standstill of time. It helped me to connect to her in a very safe and intimate way, bringing me back in time to my vibrant mother who was forever reciting poems. The poems formed structure, provided both of us with a creative defense, the fear of death, and against the potentially destructive force of timelessness. The innumerable poems my mother knew by heart were like colorful beads strung together, an experience of her life, her personal and historical time in concentric layers of memory. For my mother, reading, studying, and reciting poetry was a means of self-expression. The poems connected her to her own internal life and creativity. From the time I was a little girl throughout my life, these poems have helped me understand my mother's emotions, and they have been my guide on the path to her unconscious. A few words about the book. So as you could see, I grew up with death. Basically, always on the front steps. In this new book, Art and Mourning, the role of creativity in healing trauma and loss grew out of my 30 years involvement in art psychotherapy, psychoanalysis, and psycho-oncology. With people who have experienced early loss and trauma, as well as cancer patients and survivors in university hospitals in Zurich, Tel Aviv and LA. With paint and brushes and scissors, fabric, pen, writing, I've guided people who came to my office or who were hospitalized in outpatient clinics for intense chemo or radiation treatment or who came to healing arts groups before or after intense medical experience to project their fears, hopes and other complex emotional states onto the paper and canvas, and then followed up with individuals and group discussion. Together we have tried to understand and interpret these personal imagery and creative experience, and sometimes discussed how unresolved conflicts from the past have stood in the way of a full psychological recovery. With cancer, after cancer, other medical or psychological trauma. How are we doing with time?
Maybe next
5 minutes?
5 minutes, yeah.
Okay. Realizing the amazing power of creative expression when faced with trauma and loss, I guided them to become better artists. Art making is not only a lifeline, it's also a way to reconsider life anew and even hold off death. My psychoanalytic training taught me to be beyond the obvious, to consider the therapeutic relationship in all of its facets and to help them to face the often tragic consequences of their journey with loss and trauma or with cancer and illness, however long or short they may be. In Art and Mourning, I will demonstrate how art, and we will demonstrate today by these three artists who will we hear from today, how art, literature, and other creative work can embody a traumatic loss and its mourning. The creative formal embodiment of a piece of art can also be a powerful tool to reawaken one's psychic life and change one's experience and perception of time. I will discuss specific sculptures in the book by Alberto Giacometti, Bourgeois, Eva Hesse, Rilke, Hodler, Dina Gottliebova, Magritte, and through personal letters, Einstein's ideas about creative reverie. I think I leave it at that, as hopefully you will all of you buy my book and you can read the incredible, powerful tool artistic expression provides in working through loss and mourning in the present or after many years. Thank you very much. Dear Jane, I'm so happy to see you again. Last time we met in LA and in New York. And as Jane knows, I'm not only a fan of Jane's art, which I exhibited in LA, helped her exhibit in LA in our Psychoanalytic Institute and in a fancy gallery, but I'm also a fan about her father's art, and that's why I devoted a whole chapter on him. I know, Jane, that towards the end of his life, you had the privilege and the courage to sit with your father, and you made sketches of him. And I just feel that must have been such an intense, emotional and powerful moments for you to be there with him in that very private and very creative way. And I thought if you could just elaborate a little bit in words and in your art, how you dealt with it, the loss and afterwards the grief, particularly since you are an artist through your artistic expression. And so I give you the floor now.
Okay. Well, thank you, Esther. It's so lovely to see you again. Can everyone hear me? Okay. I think that when I received the questions from Esther, I felt quite shocked because it's such a private thing, you know, being with your parents when they die. And so I thought, well, what am I going to do? You know, all these people are coming. And actually, I'm finding it really difficult to compose answers to the questions. But then I realized that all those feelings had gone into the works that I'd made. The art is an expression of the process of mourning. And so I thought I would show you some pictures, if that's okay. And then I'll speak alongside the pictures. So I think mourning is part of what drives the art process. The concerns in art, life, death, and sex, our inner truths, are also at the core of the primary drives in psychoanalysis, with eros and thanatos, love and death, where we came from, our parents' union, our birth. My work since my mother's and my father's deaths seemed to be full of longing. which is, I think, a form of ongoing mourning. Life is, after all, a long list of losses on the journey in preparation for the greatest final loss of life itself. However, art is not therapy. The aims are different. Therapy exercises one's demons, and art entertains them. For this presentation, I will show recent works to illustrate... Oh, what's that? It's a ghost. Oh, is it me? Oh, oh dear. For this presentation, I will show recent works to illustrate how I channel my own demons regarding the array of life's fears and losses we all entertain. For my works, I've learned to trust random objects in my studio in tandem with my unconscious processes regarding selection of those objects. The two things together, that is, having a collection of unusual objects in sight and moving amongst them, help me to compose the works. To walk amongst things that inform each other is often all it takes. Thinking about this reminds me of Freud's discovery that stones speak. Sigmund Freud's discovery. This recent work is called Sit. You may note there's a space between the S and the IT. Well, the it, the S and the it. One might also note the chair is empty. The work is not for sitting on, as it's a broken chair, unobviously broken, and would collapse if sat on. So sit is an instruction, as an instruction, is taken on through the image of the chair. Sit as an instruction is taken on through the image of the chair. I remember how my father, when he finally got up to paint under Bacon's instruction, he said that he never sat down again. Standing and moving around freed him up and gave him more perspective. This moving around when working also reminds me of something I read about Sigmund, who liked to swing his legs over the arm of the chair while he was working. This slide is from my very recent exhibition in South Korea at the Wuyang Contemporary Art Museum, where my works made following my father's death still reside. I loved that reflected in the entrance to the museum when we arrived was part of the installation I named Stone Speak. Of course, after Sigmund's exclamation about his antiquities. And I loved how the actual installation looked on show with its reflection below. The family room was one of the many themed rooms in the vast museum, and it includes some of the heads of my father, Esther mentioned, perhaps. Also my husband is there. This is a close-up of one of Lucien's heads. And my husband just poking his head in there. The living and the dead. This is an installation shot showing one side of the large Lucien head on the floor and its reflection in the mirror. So can you see the head and then the other side of the head reflected in the mirror? So this side that you can see is look like the sleeping head or maybe, you know, the death head. And the other side is a close-up of the, like, the living head, very intense head, who is very intense right up until the end. This slide is the work in context, showing some of the vast spaces of the museum. So it had about, had to fill about, say about 12 rooms, I think, 11 or 12 rooms with, it was a retrospective, so it went back to 1981. The work. My installation called Freud Study Merge represents Sigmund's study merged with my studio. This is one side of the room where you can see the photo Carol helped me with. I needed a large photo of good quality, and Carol kindly sourced it in the museum. So thank you very much, Carol, for that. So it's just at the end of the one side of that installation. This is the other side of the installation. You can see the cabinet there, the couch, the desk. All the objects, sort of as they are in Freud's study, I try to replicate that sort of placing, but exchange Freud's objects with mine. This is the detail of the couch where I'm having a little rest there. With other object replacements, you know, the pictures on the walls were replaced with my etchings and stuff. The chair at the back. This is a detail of the couch itself, which they sourced these cushions and everything, and I just thought they made it so beautifully. I mean, I'd like to take responsibility for all the fabric choices, but the curator was brilliant, and she told her what I wanted, and she found the stuff, you know. She looked at the picture and tried to match it up as best they could with a sort of Korean fabric. I also let them have 63 sketchbooks. Now, sketchbooks are so personal. You can see them on the, you can see them on the screen, but that was really difficult to let 63 of them go. I'm quite shocked that I've done that, actually, and that I'm not too worried about it. Something's shifted, really. I used to be very precious about my work, particularly the sketchbook. But now I feel more normal about them, not so obsessive and sort of not like hanging myself worth on every work, which I think I definitely used to do. I think that's shifted. You can see the desk on the next slide in the left. Well, what, Freud's desk, my desk, merging between the two. But a close-up of the desk here is where I've put all my objects. If you can see, they're sort of, they are a bit libidinous, some of them, and they're sort of, I don't know, sketchbook open, just little bronze things, little what I call knick-knacks that I make, collect, that sort of thing. Yeah, some are bronze, some are clay, fired. Some ones are tortoiseshell over in that corner. So I sort of tried to place them symbolically in a way, but in the end, you know, as an artist, I wanted it to look good. So I placed them visually rather than, like the bear in the west and the monkey in the east. I sort of just put where the colors went together and the forms seemed to echo each other. So the next slide, following this Duchampian appropriation, I'm showing this, another work of mine, an easy climb ladder, which was exhibited between two doors. This is a recent work I made for a group show in Athens, but in hindsight, I note that this is a redesign of a standard ladder, and it looks a lot safer and more natural. Perhaps it's a lady ladder. Amongst all the stuff of the great fathers. But my final slide says, what I miss most is being fixed in my father's turquoise gaze. And this is a sort of ode to that feeling. So that's really what I wanted to say about art and mourning as regards loss. I've tried to use up all the time. There's 20 minutes to go. Oh, hell! Have you not got anything? Thank you for listening to me.
I think, as you said, Jane, it is so very personal to talk about intimacy. Intimacy in general, and it's more difficult to talk about intimacy with a parent.
No, with strangers, let's say, it's even more difficult. Right. In public, with strangers.
About a parent in public, and a famous parent as that. and an intense parent. As you said, that's one of the things, the intensity, and you must have felt it more than most, I would think. Basically what I understood, what you showed us all, that your way to work through that loss and mourning was by doing art. And as you did it, I was wondering, did you feel a closeness, a comfort? I mean, you also had to deal with the difficult materials at time, but when you were more relaxed about the materials, did you have access to your own feelings?
I definitely felt a presence, yeah. And I was very quiet. When I was working in my studio from the drawings I'd made, it was very strange because I worked with a lot of people there, well, a lot of people once a week on one day, and I found I wanted to work on that piece also with all those people around. But I didn't really speak to them. Normally I'm quite chatty. And I was so quiet and focused and like driven. I felt really driven, almost as though sort of held, like it was really important. I don't know, like it wasn't me doing it somehow. So I did feel his presence. I mean, obviously it's a projection of a need to feel the ongoing life force. But I enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. I didn't question it and chuck it out as nonsense. I really loved that feeling. It was very helpful.
Right, yeah. Right.
What else?
And how was that? I mean, you obviously are free to say as much or as little as you want, as it is an intimate process. How was it when your father was alive and you were sitting there? I remember earlier, many years earlier, you told me that you made sculptures of each other, and it was quite a playful thing. It was a whole different thing. And how was it then so many years later sitting there and making these sketches?
Oh, it was as though no time had passed and we were carrying on from before. It was very odd in that regard.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
This time I had the baton somehow because he, like, couldn't... We worked from each other. He really didn't like sitting and didn't like being passive. He did it in his lifetime, but he really hated it. He wanted to be doing something, but then I'm the same. I like to be doing something. And so I found that interesting, that I was the one working and he was sitting, but very intensely trying to make everything look. I don't know why he did that, but he always liked to taut all the muscles in his face so that he was perhaps thought that was the normal way. And I thought, how could he hold that position? You'd think he'd be an expert sitter, having all those people sitting, but he was trying to hold that position of really clenching the... Maybe it's like we're all vain, aren't we? Maybe it was a vanity thing. But I felt sorry that he seemed so keen to look the part or something, that he couldn't just relax and look like, you know, peaceful. It was so intense, but he was actually very physically agile right up until the end. Could spring out of bed and run around to his ensuite like that. You know, like more physically agile than me, you know, at that age. So I thought he was so alive and so intense and then so asleep. But it was very odd, like, going from one thing to the other like that. But I just carried on drawing, and even when he was like drifting off or very lively or, I don't know, it was a third thing between us. It helped.
That I just wanted to say that, that I think something. That drawing, the piece of art or the book is a very good defense. It's something in between, which allows you to go close to the emotions involved with it. It's not talking directly. But you create, and there is a space in between the loved one and the artist. And that's, I think, a very important concept. And it gives you the safety to play in that space you have on your pad or in the book you're writing or in the drawing paper. I was wondering, how are we doing with time?
We're fine, we've got 15 minutes.
Yes, so I was wondering if maybe one of you has a question about the process, an example or any idea.
Or any questions generally.
Yes.
I just wondered about how it felt at different stages. You know, obviously over time the mourning process changes. Did that have an effect on your art? You know, did you
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think it's it changes into longing. So from being very much trying to resurrect the dead in a way, it turns into a sort of a poetic sort of channeling exercise to deposit your one's longing. I really like it, actually. And I'm so productive. I was so productive after my father died. I can't tell you, just so enjoying my work and quite euphoric in a strange way when I was with him and just leaving him just towards those last days. Because of his neediness, I think. He just never wanted me to go. I'm sure he must have been like that with everyone. It was just that not liking change. Like, if you're there, then that's it. That is forever. You know, so whoever's there mustn't leave somehow. But I now can make works like this, which I think are so obliquely addressing the subject, which is so much more interesting, I think, than a... Okay, like a standard portrait head, maybe, which is a bit traditional, perhaps. I like the works better I'm doing now. Sorry, yeah.
I just wondered, in terms of your comment about the, how it influenced your work, in this artwork, you mentioned the word turquoise, and is that the turquoise color is in relation to your father?
His eyes. It says it here. Fix me in your turquoise gaze. What sort of question do you mean? I mean, what do you mean?
By, in the sense that I guess it was still influencing your work, the loss of your
father. Yeah, of course. But in that oblique way now, that loss is, all loss is, art is about loss. Art is about death, sex, loss. That the stuff of the primal drives. So, yeah, in that way, yeah.
Yes.
I found the construct of your chair deeply moving, and it made me wonder how much of your creativity is done actually sitting, and whether your observations are different to when you're standing.
Oh, I love that question.
And also in parallel with analysis, I was wondering about Freud sitting back in his chair and wanting his patient to be lying down. Do you actually sketch lying down?
I really like this thing about movement. It's very new. I'm discovering something's really interesting about standing, walking and thinking, conceptualizing and sitting and thinking. When you're sitting, you're sort of designing. When you're walking around or moving, I'm talking about myself here, I am, using my unconscious so much more and my periphery vision and my knowledge without knowing of what these objects are and where they are and how they, I pick things up without even knowing I'm doing it and put them with other things and think, oh, wow, that, like, pole there, rusty old pole, fits beautifully in that wooden thing with a base thing that is actually from some television stand. Oh, that, you know everything, really, while you're walking somehow. And I semi-lie down while sketching in the morning. So it's not sitting or lying. It's like that way of being a bit like that. And that has a sort of more designs come out, not designs, but more rational thoughts, lots of ideas and titles and the position. So important. Why does nobody ever talk about this? Maybe Freud did with all this, having the patient lying, him sitting in a chair. I don't know. I don't think we're conscious of the body as much as, you know, in its relation to the mind as much as would be useful, helpful, and give information. I think it would give a lot of information if somebody did some research. Do some research on that psychoanalysis. Yes.
I was wondering, since we're in the background of psychoanalysis, what your views are on the difference between approaching a feeling of mourning through psychoanalysis or through art, which to me seems one is very rational, whereas the other is much more irrational. Or do you have any?
Which is the irrational one?
Well, I'm just maybe you can enlighten me on that. Psychoanalysis to me feels more using language to understand your feelings, whereas art feels more like expressing something without using.
I think there are massive overlaps, and I really think psychoanalysis uses so much of the unconscious processes on both parts to make that third thing in the middle. I think the stuff that shifts and changes is not through the spoken word in psychoanalysis, it's through some other thing that neither party probably understands fully. Don't you agree or not? Where things happen, where information is gleaned, where... Don't you think it must be like that?
I think there is not one or another. It's one is for certain people. It needs both some kind of a psychoanalytic therapy or psychotherapy to work through a very deep loss or a hidden loss from the past or an encrypted loss one can't get to. There is more complicated mourning and there is more straightforward mourning. But I do think people who have or are comfortable in creative expression, that can be an additional amazing help. And often these things can also go hand in hand. One informs the other.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with that, Esther.
Yes.
I just wondered, the wonderful talk, of James. Did you ever find that the processes of mourning and loss have hijacked the work, or had that feeling of you're thinking of doing something and then it comes in and sort of takes you off in a different direction, maybe you don't.
Oh, that's
really
so
like
interesting.
That, or did you just let it happen?
Yeah. Do you know, that's interesting because I've not thought about that at all, or even as a problem in any way. It's only helped, not hindered. It's helped make the work less Twitter and biscuit. You know, artists, we're quite angry people in many ways. We sort of have to be because it's like you'd be depressed or an angry angry young man. You know, a creative person is a sort of slightly angry person, naturally. And I think it comes out in the work, which is terrible. And so... Oh, it saves me from myself, you know. It's great. So I like that it's turned into a sort of longing, made the work look more... I love it when I make something that isn't bitter and twisted, and I think, oh, well, that's part of me, that's nice, and it's got longing, and I like that. I like the poetic, yeah.
I think what is interesting in your work, when I think about Los Angeles, you know, your work was so much more conceptual, thought through. It was intellectual, and I think this work seems so, it's obviously also, you need some concept with it and everything, but it's much more fluid.
That's so interesting. I haven't seen that shift. No,
yeah,
I haven't seen it, but I know what you mean now, you're saying.
Softer and fluid.
It's in progress, though, remember. I haven't had time to intellectualize it. Once I interrogate it, it'll come across probably a little bit more... protective, you know, because we protect ourselves, don't we, with the layering of the intellectualizing, you know. So it might change, but I did like your question, yeah. Yeah, we've still got like 7 minutes, haven't we? So if there's any more.
Well, Esther, I didn't know whether you wanted to reflect a little bit more just on some of what Jane has said in relation to some of the things that you... written about in the book.
Yes, you know, what comes to mind is one Swiss artist, Ferdinand Hodler. I'm sure in Europe he's a little better known than in the States. He's one of the most well-known Swiss artist around the turn of last century. And he made one of the most beautiful group of drawings, paintings, and one sculpture of his lover and model, Valentin Godet-Darel. And he did these beautiful, beautiful images, some in paint and in different media, about her slow dying of breast cancer, which was at that time, you know, in the 1920, or was a very terminal disease, unlike today in most cases. These two people had a very stormy relationship. He was even married at the time, and but the sensitivity to it seemed like that was his only way he could actually mourn. And when I addressed the complicated mourning situation, he had a very complicated mourning situation. He had lost nearly both his father and his mother when he was a child, and some of his siblings on a disease which was going around, and there were no antibiotics. He even, as a child, had to pull the cart with his mother to the cemetery. It was these drawings which really helped him, not only to work through the loss of his lover, but also, I believe, working through the past losses of his childhood. They were extremely sensitive, and I think when Valentin was conscious and well together, she really enjoyed that intimacy, which he barely was capable in a social sense to stay long enough emotionally intimate with her, but he could do it with that defense of a canvas in between. And these works are extremely moving. I mean, they belong to the canon of great, great pictures of loss and mourning. And I think that, at that time there was no psychoanalysis, or it was in the very early times, and he would have never been capable to sit with somebody in a intimate discussion about the loss he goes through. He wouldn't have found the words, and I think that happens to a lot of painters or artists. It's really the work they have to do, the actual doing it. But the interesting thing with this particular artist was that it was all expressed in the drawing. Here and there, there was entrance, you know, in his diary, what Valentin asked. She would ask, do you think I'm going to die? There was such an intimacy that she dared to ask. And he couldn't really answer, but he answered in pictures. And sometimes I do wonder how it must have been later in the process. Was it annoying for her to be, you know, and I was thinking about that too. Was it annoying for her to be drawn? But I think since she must have known the only intimacy she could get in that moment was together with being painted. It's very, very moving. And I think that is the same for any artistic expression, as in writing or
can I just interject?
Creating music. Or, mm. Yeah.
I know you were thinking about that, the connotation of saying you're wondering whether it might be annoying for the sitter because
right.
they can't get out of it. Well, the interesting thing about my experience was that was my father's, always he wanted me to, because I make medals as well, he always wanted me to reassure him that I would make one of him as a memento mori, which I did do in the end. So that was our sort of joke when he was alive and, you know, very intense and, that I would do that medal of him when, as a memento mori. So he was always waiting. I'm ready, you know, I'm always waiting. So it was something he wanted, and that we'd discussed like for 20 years sort of thing.
Yeah, and in the end you did.
So it wasn't like he was sitting there, he was really excited about it. So he wanted to do it.
And this naturally is a memorial not only for Jane, for everybody who sees the medal, and the same for Valentine. You know, it's left for a memorial for all of us to partake in, and so it actually lives on, and it survives us, and that is a comforting thought.